Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Aaron Taylor is the lead college football game analyst for CBS Sports Network. You can catch him Tuesdays throughout the season in studio with the latest college football news and analysis on Inside College Football. Taylor also serves as a game analyst for the SEC on CBS. Many people remember Taylor playing offensive line for Notre Dame and the Super Bowl champion Green Bay Packers in the 1990s. Aaron's going to be calling the first game of the 2017 season as Oregon State takes on Colorado State Saturday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern on CBS Sports Network. Aaron, so I'm going to put you on the spot. What is the best environment to catch a game in college football?
Man, I would have said South Bend back in the day, but that has changed a little bit as we've modernized our stadium and joined the arms race there. So I'll go to maybe my professional career with the Packers, man. I mean, there was something to be said about playing in a stadium in a town of 100,000 where you're a professional football team, but you're followed and revered, win, lose, or draw, like you're a collegiate university. So there was something to be said about, you know, dun 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 dun, go Pack, go, and all the different chants that we had, and jumping in the stands was coming online at that time. And oh yeah, we went to back-to-back Super Bowls, and Favre won 3 MVPs while I was there, so that was pretty good too. But I think when I look around the places that I've been that have had the biggest impact on me, I think Tennessee, when I played Knoxville, I think it was my freshman year at Notre Dame, was without question the loudest outdoor stadium I'd ever played in. And that includes the Kansas City Chiefs or Seattle or some of the other loud places that we played, Detroit, Minnesota with the Vikings, that sort of thing. But LSU at night is hard to beat. Either of the Death Valleys, Clemson, is hard to beat. There's some unbelievable environments. And I really think that on the college side, that's what really is the separator between college sports and the NFL, is the environments and the passionate fan bases. It's not corporate like the NFL, and there's some good NFL fan bases, but in college, it's across the board, and that's what I think makes this level of football so special.
You've been at CBS for 10 years now. Is there anything that really stands out in your mind as the coolest game that you've experienced as a broadcaster there?
Man, TCU Utah, when they were both, I think, 3-4 at the time, was a huge game. We've had some epic finishes down the stretch, including last year with the Cal-San Diego State game, Wyoming-San Diego State, the ending of this one this past year. There's just been some really good personal moments when I've been on the road, and then there's been some also meaningful moments, I think, in some good ways and not so good ways. I particularly remember kind of Brian Jones and myself sharing part of our personal histories about what had taken place with sexual abuse when all the stuff came down with Penn State. So that's maybe a little bit more heavy and a serious of a topic. But I think the culmination of both of those in kind of bracketing the spectrum really illustrates for me the difference that I think really separates CBS in a lot of ways, which is the family aspect of it. Like DJ, I just got a thing on my LinkedIn that said that, you know, he's celebrating a 12-year anniversary working at that company. So it's a place where people end up and they like being there and tend to spend a lot of time there. So I think overall, when I look back, the thing I miss most as a player, Ryan, is being a meaningful part of a team. And I get that to a large degree. It's not identical, but very similar, working for CBS and calling games on the road with the same 40 people every weekend and going in the studio with Adam and BJ and Rick and Zucker and, you know, all the people that are associated with that. So it's, when I look back on everything, man, it's, I'm pretty damn lucky to do what I've done and be a part of the teams that I've been a part of, and CBS is certainly among the tops.
Is there anyone in the SEC this year you can see knocking Alabama off their perch?
Man, it's interesting. That's a good question. I think when you look in the West, Auburn is certainly capable of doing that. I think there's a lot of unknowns with Jarrett Stidham and what he's going to do. I think the assumption, and certainly my assumption, is that the way Auburn finished the season last year, if you can put somebody underneath center and the shotgun in a lot of respects in that offense, that added element would be enough to give them a run for their money. Alabama lost a lot of people on the defensive side, but I think Nick Saban has proved over the years that, you know, he can reload and rebuild, whether it's on offense or defense, in certain cases both. So it's possible, but I don't think it's probable. I've got them going back to the college football playoff for a third year in a row, and maybe it's going to be an odd year. Maybe they'll win it like they did a couple of years ago. But LSU, I think is always going to be a team that's good. I think defensively they lost a ton of tremendous players. I know everybody's focused on Arden Key and whether or not he's going to be able to play, but you lose a guy like Jamal Adams, and some of the other players that they lost on that side of the ball, those aren't easily replaceable, but you certainly like some of the things that they bring to the table. But I think that's really the story, that when you look across the conference, Alabama's the cream of the crop, and there used to be a lot more parity in the SEC than there is now, but it's really kind of become a top-heavy conference, and I think there's a strong argument to say that it's the ACC that's the best conference top to bottom, certainly recently. And Alabama may have passed that crown a little bit.
You played at Notre Dame, as we mentioned. I went to Wisconsin, and I'm a diehard Packers fan. With this Wisconsin-Notre Dame home and home, I totally agree with you. Lambeau's a cathedral, but Soldier Field is not. And because of that, I would prefer that these games be played on campus as opposed to in Chicago and Green Bay. How do you feel about this home and home that's going to be coming up?
Yeah, I'm with you, man. I'm an old school guy, and we wore black shoes and, you know, no names on our jersey and looking at Touchdown Jesus. And now there's, you know, video screens and fake turf and, you know, skyboxes in the stadium, man. It's crazy. So, that's just kind of the nature of this beast and the natural evolution of what's taken place and the unfortunate reality of the popularity of collegiate athletics, particularly football, is that it's a very economic-driven sport. So it makes more sense. There's more to do. There's more overall money and revenue to be generated when you play in downtown Chicago or in Green Bay, Wisconsin. There, it's a sexier feel and a more unique experience. And I think that that's part of the allure of doing that, is the compatibility of these two Midwest teams that come from these small towns playing in kind of these professional venues so that they can tap into fan bases in major metropolitan areas. Not that Green Bay is a town of 100,000 is major, but the NFL tie-in, I think, sexies it up a little bit, that to the powers that be that are putting these games together along with the television partners, it makes for a more compelling, newsworthy game. And we all know that that drives clicks and revenue and all that sort of stuff. But I'm with you, man. I wish they would take the face mask off and play it in the parking lot somewhere. That would be what I'm voting for.
I don't know. I just feel like they'd fill Camp Randall for Wisconsin Notre Dame. And Camp Randall's bigger than Soldier Field, and it's bigger than Lambeau. It holds more people. So I don't get the why they are playing these games off campus. I can't imagine the television makes any difference, but I guess you work in television and you seem to think so.
Yeah, I mean, it's the bottom line's the bottom line in college football. So the conventional thinking, I'm with you, Ryan, 100%. It makes more sense to play it on campus. I was all about the Pac-12 having their championship game on the team that's got the best record. Then they went away from that. And a lot of that was infrastructure and being able to turn things around quickly, which is a little bit of a different situation than you have with this, when it's well known in advance, you know, who the two teams are going to be, to allow for traveling and those sort of things. But I'm a proponent of that. I think that's part of what the college football playoff committee, I would love to see those be games that take place on collegiate environments, man. I, I played in NFL stadiums plenty. I've certainly had plenty of experiences playing around the country nationally due to Notre Dame and the schedule that we played when I was campus there, and they still do. And it's just, to me, it's a better experience. It's more authentic, I think, is the word that I'm looking for. But there's also something to be said about the Jerry World games. We're all looking forward to Alabama, Florida State, and there's no way that that would have happened in a home-and-home situation.
Speaking of games on campus, I'd be in favor of an 8-team college football playoff with the first round of games on campus. How would you feel about that?
Yeah, there's two different issues there. I think assuming for a second that we are going to go to 8, and I think that's when, not if. So I'm in agreement with you there. I think it's going to happen. I think that's a great idea that you lay out because of everything we just discussed. And that's, you know, the authenticity and rewarding the team that's earned that right by their play on the field to have that advantage. I think that there's something to be said about that. With that said, should we keep it 4 or go to 8? I think the economics at some point are going to force the hand there, no different than the BCS that was designed only to pair the two best teams together. We've seen already that 4 is more lucrative and better than 2, but I think what we've also seen is a diminishing of the New Year's 6 and some of the other bowl games. I think we've seen a diminishing last year with Ohio State going to the playoff, where Penn State wins their dang conference and doesn't get a chance to go. So we're already seeing the early unintended consequences of going to a quote-unquote playoff system. And I think college football be able to be very careful about doing anything that's going to diminish the regular season like we've seen in basketball, because I think that every game matters mentality is what makes this sport what it is.
I can see that, but I think 8 is just the right amount, because then you don't have teams like Penn State, as you mentioned, getting screwed. And it's a lot easier. Of course, there's always going to be a bubble, but it's a lot easier to rationalize keeping a team that might be the 8th or the 9th best team in the country out versus a team that might be the 4th best team out.
I'm in agreement with you, but then there's going to be the 9th team that's going to be pissed that they didn't get in. They're going to have, you know, strong, compelling arguments when they compare resumes and strength of schedules, where how can you leave these guys in and not those guys? And that's, I think, the bigger concern here, Ryan, is the slippery slopes that would create. And the excuse that they floated up was all the season's too long and put too much demand on players, I think, initially was bull jive. I think if you get into an 8-team scenario and everybody plays and there's no buys, then that does start to become a much longer season that has been lengthened. We've seen already this year with the no two-a-days policy that's come online this year. And the coaches largely tell me that they really like that and they're a fan of that, because there's more teaching, that it's kind of gone, you know, one physical practice a day, but they still have two mental practices a day with the walkthroughs around it. But it's meant that they're in camp longer. These guys are starting to play football more year-round, and if they want to have any sort of chance, and I'm talking about the institution of collegiate athletics, of maintaining any sort of modicum where there's even a veil of the possibility that it's amateurized and that education matters, then I think those are some of the forces that are going to push back against an 8 or, you know, going beyond that. I think the other thing that needs to be considered when we have this conversation is the natural divide that's already occurring between the have and the have-nots, and that's that the rich are getting richer. I think a couple years ago when we started to hear about the autonomous 5, about the power 5 and the group of 5, that it's almost like a mason or somebody that keeps scoring a rock, and at some point you hit it and it's a clean break. I think that that's something that we can expect in the next 20 years, because the big boys are going to get tired of floating the smaller schools. And I think that the super conference model's an inevitability. I think it's going to take longer than people think, but that we're heading there. And then that's going to answer all the questions about the playoff, because it'll happen internally within the super conferences.
Brian Kelly went 4-8 last year. A lot of people said that he should have been fired last year. I don't pretend to have an intimate knowledge of it or anything, but from afar, it doesn't help his cause that he doesn't have a very sunny disposition. If you were in charge of like the Notre Dame athletic department, Would you have hired a new coach for this year? And what do you think he has to do to save his job for 2018?
Man, that's an interesting question that a lot of Irish fans are mulling over around the country. I'll say this. Among the brightest people I've ever met in my life is Jack Swarbrick, Notre Dame's athletic director. He's one of the few people that I've talked to that every single time that we talk, he gives me a new perspective on something that I've never considered. And that's rare. And I think he's got a pretty good grasp on the situation. And he's somebody that is not a knee-jerk reactor and stays way ahead of decisions. So that's why when Bob Stoops suddenly retired, and knowing how much of an Irish fan he is and the fact that he owns a residence in Chicago and loves the Midwest, you know, everybody kind of went, that's some weird stars aligning. Let's not forget, Notre Dame was in the national championship game a couple years ago in 2012. And certainly, you know, they got lucky to get there and it was kind of circumstantial. And they certainly didn't represent themselves very well once they got there. Alabama kind of had their way with us. But I think there's still enough meat on the Brian Kelly bone that warrants giving him another year, particularly with Brandon Wimbush, who a lot of people are high on. I've seen him with my own eyes, and I would agree that, you know, his ceiling is very high. I think what has me most encouraged about what Notre Dame fans can expect from the Irish is I think there's going to be a recommitment to the run. I think the new offensive coordinator, Chip Long, coming in, I was there in early August and watched a couple different practices and having some chats with him. Harry Hiestand, the offensive line coach, told me he's never had an offensive coordinator spend as much time in the O-line room as Chip Long has. Man, that is music to my ears, bud. And I'm sure as an Irish fan, that may be to yours too, because it means that Notre Dame offensively might get back to the only thing that gives them a chance, I think, to compete on the national landscape, and that's to be a physical football team. I think we got swept up in the hurry-up, no-huddle spread and tried to get too cute. We tried to recruit cute players instead of the people and the kids from the Midwest that are blue-collar workers that aren't entitled, that are willing to do whatever it takes to compete and have that kind of blue-collar attitude and are willing to swing the axe. I think we've gotten away from that a little bit, and I think offensively that's had negative effects on our own defense, and I think it's well established that we got maybe too complicated defensively, and you combine all that, and now all of a sudden Notre Dame's, you know, been irrelevant largely for the better part of, you know, 2.5 decades. So I think getting back to the fundamentals of what built this sport, what makes it what it is, which is it's a physical, tough man sport that is involved with blocking and tackling. I think Notre Dame's going to get back to that, and I think going to be have a chance to reverse their record from a year ago instead of being 4-8 to be 8-4 at a minimum, and I think could be one of the surprise teams in 2017.
Changing the topic to your NFL memories, this is going to be a little bit hard to conceptualize, but does it feel better to win a Super Bowl or worse to lose one on like the ends of the spectrum?
Oh man, which one of your kids would you want to drown first? I'll tell you what, the Lou Holtz used to always say, man, and I just want to honor him for a second because he taught us more about life in 4 years without us having any clue that that was going on, more so than anybody that I've ever encountered or ever heard of. There's some great coaches that teach people about life, but he was well known for saying, you know, there's nothing worse in life than a missed opportunity. Well, he said, son, there's nothing worse in life than a missed opportunity. And I learned that to be true in 1993 when we beat Florida State. I turned 21 at midnight. I was a senior captain, and we were ranked number one in the country for about 6 days. Because we went out the next week, even with the great leadership that we had and all that talent, and found a way to lose to Boston College. That's the worst loss I've ever felt. I won Super Bowl 31. I'm looking at a picture in my office right now, Brett Favre jumping in my arms. My arms up in the air was after we made that check. I think it was a touchdown to Andre Rison.
In the second quarter?
Yeah. That game was unbelievable. It's the only time in my life, man, and I'm kind of chasing this thought a little bit, so bear with me. The only time in my life that there was nothing left to do. We did it. There was no next week. There was, hey, you know, good job, or one step closer. It was like, that was it. And because of that, it was surreal when the confetti started coming down and we're all like little kids, like clapping our hands, like, oh my gosh, we actually freaking won. Wow. And it lasted about a month. And then, you know, you move on and kind of go and do your thing. So getting back to the Super Bowl, maybe being a little overconfident and maybe being banged up in key positions that allowed Terrell Davis, who's a Hall of Fame running back and had a hell of a game along with John Elway, I think we're overconfident there and it caught us. So to lose that Super Bowl on the heels of winning one the year before was devastating, because to win a Super Bowl, you have to not only be extremely talented, you got to be pretty damn lucky. And we were. Things bounced our way that year. So to get back and have that slip through our hands was awful. But I'll be honest, man, of those two losses, 1993 to Boston College and losing Super Bowl 32, it ain't even close. The hardest I've ever cried in my life was when we lost to Boston College as a senior captain, knowing we lost our one opportunity to be the national champions. We had to put it in other people's hands, and sure enough, they handed it to Bobby Bowden. That was the worst thing I've ever felt. So your original question was, how would I compare those two? It's hard to say. I think looking back, I value them. I'm somebody that believes that, you know, things happen for a reason. And even all the mistakes and trials and tribulations that I've been through, and there's been a fair amount, some have, you know, been publicly discussed and others not. But I would keep it as it is, man. The losses and the rallying and the camaraderie that took place after the BC loss in 1993 are equally rich in my mind and from an experiential standpoint as the picture that I'm looking at and the 50-year anniversary of the Super Bowl ball that's also, you know, on my bookshelf somewhere and all the Super Bowl memories in my ring and all that stuff. So that's probably a chicken shit answer to your question and extremely long-winded, but it's good to think about that stuff because it both are equal parts of a career that I very much value and feel super blessed to have taken part of.
So you're there in 97. The Favre's won three straight MVPs. It seems like he really could go on to be indisputably the greatest quarterback of all time. But at the same time, the relationship between Ron Wolf and Mike Holmgren is beginning to fray to the point where Holmgren leaves after the Super Bowl loss to go to Seattle. As a player in that situation, how aware are you of a purported power struggle between the coach and the general manager?
It's interesting. Like, I remember like hearing rumblings about that, but it's like any other work drama, right? Like, you know, there's always somebody internally in this department that doesn't like that department. I mean, it happens at CBS, it happens at every company across the country, including your own. So I think through the eyes of a 23 or 24 year old at the time, it was like, you know, so-and-so may not like so-and-so, but what's that got to do about, you know, me blocking John Randall or Warren Sapp or getting ready for the Super Bowl and, you know, blocking those guys that we're going to be playing against there. So I think we had heard rumblings, but you don't have the perspective and certainly the maturity of the experience from my standpoint to look at it and go, oh my gosh, this could be the ending of a dynasty if these two guys aren't getting along. You got to remember, inside an NFL locker room, that it is common to mother scratch players to players face to face, for coaches and players to MRF each other on the sidelines and then go drink a beer after. Oh, you were pissed at me, man. I was about to hit you, coach. Oh, you about to hit me. I was about to go off on you, you know, overset and gave some more pressure on that pad play again. Like, that was kind of the culture that you were in. So even though there was tremendous trust and our locker room was solid, there was always bickering. But blood is thicker than water, and you consider yourself a family and you get through it. So I think maybe the higher level executives may have been aware of that, but I think as players, it was like, yeah, you know, ho-hum, no big deal. What does this mean to us? Because we got bigger fish to fry coming down the pipe.
Who was the dirtiest player you ever blocked against?
Dirty.
Like someone who would, man, like eye rake you if he thought he could get away there or whatever. Like go low on your knees or someone you just like despised because he didn't play the game in a way that you deem to be fair.
Now, in all fairness, Ryan, I might have been accused of being a little bit of a dirty player myself. So I had kind of a healthy respect for guys that played too, maybe a little bit through the whistle. But I think the dirtiest guy I've ever been on the field with was Bill Romanowski. And the N-word and the spitting and the nut grabbing, like all of that, you know, even though I wasn't there in those moments, is right in line with the stuff that I was a part of. And you can just watch guys on film and know, and then especially when you get on the field, you have a real good feel for kind of who they are and how they play and what their character type is, if you will. And Bill's dirty as shit, man. We played against him, I think, a couple times earlier in my career, and certainly with Super Bowl 32. The guy that talked the most junk was John Randall, the Hall of Fame defensive tackle, undersized, cat quick defensive lineman from Minnesota. And he was somebody that would read your bio and would chirp the entire game, man. Like, his mouth ran the entire time. But John was a good dude. I remember we played up there on a Monday night once, and it was part of a 7-sack game. I mean, just a disaster. We couldn't, you know, get out of our own way. It was, they whooped us up front, and I don't know how many times, you know, Favre got knocked to the ground in addition to the 7 sacks, but it was brutal. But there was a play where I was about to get pushed over the pile, and John was chirping, 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 and I was getting bent over backwards. I was like, ah! And he reached down and he grabbed me to pull me up off the pile so that the weight wouldn't, you know, with my legs locked, pull me back over. And he's like, you okay? You okay? He's like, yeah, man, thank you. He's like, good. Now get back in that huddle so I can whip your ass some more. So even though he liked to chirp and you know, he certainly backed it up, I think that the respect that NFL players have for each other, there's a code amongst us where you don't try to hurt somebody else. You might try to hurt feelings and hurt them bad, but you would never try to, you know, physically hurt a player and affect his ability to earn an income for himself or his family.
Please give me your craziest, most insane Brett Favre party story.
Oh my God. Is this G-rated? Who listens to this?
We're 27 minutes in. You can say whatever you want.
Oh my God, I like being employed and married. I can't tell you any stories about what took place in Green Bay.
Oh, come on. We want people to listen to this. We need something sexy.
I know. I'm trying to give them something, but also, again, like,
I said the craziest. I didn't say the craziest one you felt comfortable telling me.
I'll say this. Brett was a huge practical joker. So there were all sorts of times where Holmgren would come in and, you know, he would always lean on his, you know, podium. So Brett would take those little glass vials of the sulfur, like the fart little things, and would let off a stink bomb as soon as Holmgren would start talking. And he'd be like, all right, man, we got a Jesus Christ. What is that? And we would just all die laughing, man. And he had a really unique way of kind of keeping us loose, around the locker room, and great players are like that. He wanted the ball in his hands when it mattered, and I think he had a lot of confidence in himself, and there's times where, you know, maybe he had too much confidence in him, but he was a hell of a teammate. He was somebody that was, for as good as he was, even like if we were struggling up front or there was another position that wasn't doing well, it was, come on, guys, we got to do this. Give me a little bit of time. We can get these guys over the top, blah, blah, blah. We've been setting it up. It wasn't finger pointing or derogatory or negative. I think we were just too young to not know any better, man. We were all in our mid-20s in the height of our lives playing unbelievable football. And we all got along and were the same ages. So I think that's kind of the fondest memory that I have of Brett, was kind of the practical joker side. And I'll maybe leave it at that. And
can you fathom if you guys had been playing in like the TMZ era where everyone has a camera phone and everything becomes blog fodder? Wouldn't that just have like been a totally different dynamic if you had to somehow transplant this group of personalities into the modern environment?
Oh my gosh. Like, we wouldn't be having this conversation, Ryan. I'll tell you that right now. I would have been out of the league in a year and probably in jail and who knows what else, based on the stuff that we got away with back then, man. Like, it's crazy the amount of scrutiny that people are under nowadays. And we get a little smidge of it being, you know, an on-air college football dude in you know, an environment where people are passionate. But I couldn't imagine where everything that happens. We've seen some things that have happened recently in this world of Twitter where we have our president that, you know, is talking junk to other countries that have their finger on dang bombs. Like, it's crazy the amount, the size of the megaphone and the amount of awareness and scrutiny that is available to guys. So I'm blessed, man. All the old heads, we talk about that all the time. Like, thank God we played before there were camera phones, man, because we all would have went down.
Is there anything we didn't talk about, college football, broadcasting, Packers, Notre Dame, that you think is really interesting that you want to share on this platform now?
I don't know, man. This has been fun. I know it's been kind of more one way and fire hosey versus a conversation, but it's really cool for me to kind of have an opportunity to think about and relish all this stuff. I'm 44 years old. I played football most of my life. I've been involved with the game most of my life, and I'm so very blessed what this sport has given me. And what Joe Moore taught me at Notre Dame and what Lou Holtz taught me and, you know, the people and experiences that I got in the NFL and the luxuries that affords me now. Like, I get paid as my job to talk about something that I love to do. This sport is the gift that keeps on giving. And I keep that in mind in my analysis. Like, when I played, man, it was life or death. And if we won, good, we were supposed to. And if you lost, you were miserable until you won. And there was never an opportunity to really kind of enjoy the process. And that was a commitment I made to myself many years ago when I got back into television. But you know what, man? This is kind of a deal. And I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to take the game a hell of a lot more seriously than I'm going to take myself. But I'm going to try and have the fun now being part of the game in this capacity that I didn't necessarily have as a player, even though that was a career that was filled with many successes. So, the fun part of this sport, the camaraderie, is the people that we miss. We don't miss game day. We sometimes miss payday. But we miss the bond. We miss the culture. We miss our teammates. And I think ultimately, man, it's our purpose. It's our significance. And it's being a meaningful part of a team that I think is what we all relish when we think about our careers in the sport of football.
Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate your time. Best of luck this season.
Appreciate it, Ryan. Let's do this again, bud.
Definitely. We'll do it again sometime.
Such turns strange.